This episode of Storyworthy is sponsored by Story02 Software from Jungle. You guys, Story02 is fantastic. It's a way to outline and define your story. So whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, an essay, a novel, a screenplay, or even a one-person show, Story02 Software will help you get your story out there with a beginning and a middle and an end. Now, there are customizable story paradigms, character image packs, and the ability to import and export final draft. You heard me. So head on over to junglesoftware.com and check out Story02 and enter the coupon code STORYWORTHY, that's all one word, to receive 10% off. Story02 by Jungle Software. There is nothing out there like it to tell your story.
Hey, it's Ed Krasnick. You're listening to Storyworthy. Sunday! Thrills and chills and spills. Funny cars.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannah Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannah Finney, and we're coming to you from the Purple Onion in San Francisco, California. Now, the Purple Onion is a club that opened in 1952.
Wow.
And was a very important beat poetry and stand-up comedy. Woody Allen got his start here, Bob Newhart.
Woody Allen got his start in New York. What do you
well,
mean?
Well, I know, but there weren't comedy clubs in the 50s. There were places where you could like do poetry and shit like that. So people like Bob Newhart and Lenny Bruce and Woody Allen, they had, outside of New York, coffee houses that, Purple Onion was one of the few places they could do comedy.
Okay.
Why, you might ask, here?
This is fantastic because our guest tonight, Ed Krasnick, Hannes, he's been on the show before.
He has. He's a perennial, as they say.
Well, he's one
like
of my favorite guests.
He's like a vine that just keeps giving.
Sometimes you have a guest on and I think to myself, this is like butter. I barely have to wake up. I can talk with Ed Krasnick any day.
I like to think of Ed as country crock because he's spreadable and yet he's not bad for my heart.
I can't believe it's not butter.
Yeah, I can't believe it's not Krasnick.
So Ed Krasnick brings up the topic San Francisco comedy days because that's where he got his start in comedy.
Yeah.
And so did many, many, many other famous
comedians.
Probably
a little bit after Woody Allen. But we'll see. We'll see. Perhaps he went out, maybe he's doing heroin with Woody Allen in the story. We don't know.
Well, when you talk about comedy birthplaces, I think of like the Catskill Mountains and I think of New York City.
Yeah.
And then I think of San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. It was the middle of the country. It's like there was not a lot of stand-up comedy for a long time. That's why in the 80s and the 90s especially, when comedy boomed and all of a sudden, like I can still remember in Madison, Wisconsin, doing comedy at there was an improv troupe that our friend Evan, who I've known since
first grade, Gore,
was in, and I would they'd say, hey, you can do 10 minutes of stand-up before we start our improv show. And that was what I was doing. And then a comedy club, and there were a couple open mics, and then a comedy club opened like five blocks from my house, owned by Bill Kinison, Sam Kinison's brother. And I was like, gosh, show business is so easy.
They just come right
down
the street.
They literally come to you. I was like, oh, I wish there was a regular comedy club in town. There is. Awesome.
And now what year was this, 82?
No, this would have been 83, 84, something like that.
Okay. And so you started performing there at Kinison's club.
Yeah, exactly. And Sam Kinison was our first headliner a year before he became famous.
But there weren't that many famous comedians out of Milwaukee.
Out of Milwaukee, no, but there was, but this was the
but it
80s.
Was a hub.
Everybody was doing comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just all across the country, every podunk disco in every town of like 40,000 or more would pay you $75 to $100 to come in and do jokes. And it was incredible.
Hannes, what do you think went, what happened? What happened? Cable TV?
Well, it was oversaturation. No, it was the saturation and the fact that they would just take your word for you being a comedian. So you didn't have to, before they would start paying you, you didn't have to prove to them that you had like an actor, jokes, or stage personality.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm
you
not.
You mean there were no like open mics?
There were open mics, but I'm saying people, the thing was to have comedy in your venue, whatever your venue was. So they said, okay, here some guy would go in and go say, I'll put on a comedy show. You give me $400 per show. He'd pay $100 to the headliner and $75 to the middle and $50 to the host. And he'd pocket 50 and he'd make some money off drinks. And that was the way it worked. And they weren't like concerned about the quality. So because you know how everybody nowadays, but people like whatever the hot thing is like everybody thinks they can be a boy band now.
That's always been.
No, but I know. But it's like there's always whatever something percolates to the top where people who vaguely want to be in show business are like, oh, I'll be an actor. Oh, I'll be a comedian. Oh, I'll be a singer. Oh, I'll be a model. Whatever's the hot topic. And like people would just fill the space.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's like you would be watching it and you would be like, this guy's an amazing talent. I don't understand. I don't know what world this guy's living in. He's standing there talking and there's nothing happening. There's no laughter. And he gets off. He goes, ah, it felt good. Felt good. It's like what? But you have to have that delusion, even if you're a good comic. Mm. When you're starting, you have to have the delusion that the one laugh you get from the back of the room is a gale of laughter from the entire audience.
Did you ever do any comedy in San Francisco?
I have not done comedy in San Francisco. I've done it in a lot of other places. Oklahoma City.
Well, sure, that sounds
sure,
like a hotbed.
Sure, Hartford, Wisconsin, all the hotbeds. I know, a lot of L.A. Yeah, oddly enough, I've never done comedy in San
Francisco.
Don't
you think that a lot of the reason why comedy clubs aren't so popular anymore is because you can watch it on TV. You can watch any of your favorite performers anytime you want on the internet in the comfort of your own chair at home in your underwear with your own beer and your own
comforts. In San Francisco, if you went in your underwear to a comic club, they probably wouldn't. They don't judge anything.
That would
They're
work
not
out
judging
okay.
here in San I Francisco. See. But yeah, that probably has something to do with it. But people like to get... See, the thing is, it's weird, is like I like to do comedy, but like the idea that I would leave my house and go and sit in a comedy club for an hour and a half, I'd never do that. The
oh
thing
my
that
gosh,
I want
honest.
To... No, but it's like I want to watch people do things that I don't have any connection with.
But don't you want to, like, learn the craft and study what other people do?
I want to be there watching people. I'm just saying being a regular audience member.
So you'd rather sit home. That's what I said.
No. I would like to sit in the back of the comedy club and be able to come and go as I please, which is the part of being a comic that's
You're able
good.
To do that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you can, like, hang out and you'd be like, oh, well, wait, oh, this guy's going up. I'm going to go in and listen to this guy.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
Okay, but my point is, I'm asking you, why did comedy take such a dive?
Because
it just got
too big too fast. Matter of fact, it's exactly like the economic downturn. It's like the housing bubble. It was a comedy bubble.
It was a comedy bubble.
And I'm only three quarters joking. Actually, I'm not even joking at all. It was a comedy bubble. Literally, like I said, I'm sure it used to be like there was one comedy club in Milwaukee, and if you really wanted to see stand-up comedy and you lived within 30 miles of Milwaukee, you had to go to this one place. Then every bowling alley, the whole country was like this.
I get it.
I
get it.
And it's eventually you're like, okay, well, I'm done with that. Also, you're going to see, like I said, crappy shows. A lot of crappy shows.
Yeah.
A lot of crappy comics. And you're like, oh, well, this is not. It's like the difference between improv is an interesting
analogy.
Thing, because there's almost nothing better than good improv, but there's almost nothing more excruciating than bad improv. And a lot of people have been to a lot of shows of people who think that they're great improvers, and they're not.
Hmm.
And you just sitting through that, you're like, I never want to sit through another improv show again because you didn't see a good one.
Yeah, I always found doing improv is a lot more fun than watching improv. You know, like doing Groundlings classes and stuff like that that I've done in the past. I've had so much fun in every class.
I think that's exactly right, because a lot of times I'm watching the people on stage, I'm like, you guys look like you're having a blast.
Right.
Me?
Not so fun.
I'm bored. Now, you know, again, if you're watching the best...
Yeah.
Not even the best, just people who literally know what they're doing, then it's a whole other ballgame.
Okay, who do you know from San Francisco? What comics do you know, Hannes? Margaret Cho.
The
late Robin Williams.
The late Robin Williams, of course, is probably the most famous of all the San Francisco-based comics. I know also that Zach Galifianakis, Greg Proops, Joe DeFreelander, who was on 30 Rock, those guys came out of San Francisco, and especially Greg Proops is very much into his San Francisco roots. Whenever I've spoken to him, he's very much,
you know,
it's a different mind game. It's sort of a kind of a New York-y superior thing.
Yeah, there's like an intelligentsia or intelligence. How do you say that? There's an
Well, intelligentsia refers to the people, but there is a version.
Well, that's what's going on. There's an intelligentsia about the comics in San Francisco. It's at a different. It's sort of smarter.
Which is funny, but well, see, they think they're smarter, and often they are, but not always. Mm-hmm. Like there are people who are just mediocre comics who happen to have started in San Francisco, who think that they're doing something superior. They just have that attitude because it's like you're not Greg Proops.
Mm-hmm.
You're not doing something more elaborate. You're not Zach Galifianakis. You're not creating a whole different version of jokes. He's like Zach Galifianakis.
They're like
stand
groundbreakers.
Up act is like,
they're groundbreakers.
I'm creating a different version of a stand up act.
Well, it's fantastic,
right?
So they're very original
because he's good
and that's intelligent.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm saying is there are people who. Are not as good as some like a Zach Galifianakis who will be like, well, you know, I'm from San Francisco, so we're a little more intellectual.
Well, they can't all be gold. I mean,
right. You
know, now I used to date that guy, Mike Gandolfi. He was a stand up in San Francisco, and he always talked about the scene up there. Like it was very specific. He was part of that group of men and women who were doing comedy and were sort of a smarter, more intelligent, more like writers. You know what I mean? Like it was just a smarter comedy. And he always talked about it, and I never really put my finger on what he was talking about. And then Ed Krasnick brings this topic up, and I'm thinking, here we go with this San Francisco group of comics again.
Yes, perhaps.
So maybe Ed will be able to tell us.
Perhaps he can dumb it down so the rest of us can understand.
That's what I'm hoping.
He's actually wearing a cap and gown right now.
Ed is amazing. He's worked with a lot of really smart people like Wendy Liebman and Chelsea Handler, Todd Glass, Paul Gilmartin. He's worked with all these people, and so he really kind of has his mark all over Hollywood. If he were a tagger, this place would be filthy with Ed Krasnick graffiti.
And I, of course, go directly to pets. If he were a dog, the smell of his urine would be everywhere.
That's disgusting.
In really? Is it? I don't think it is.
All right, you guys. Ed Krasnick's going to be here in just a minute.
Oh, God, he's peeing right now.
But before he comes on, I did want to mention, folks, that if you'd like to support Storyworthy, and we sure would appreciate it, here's what you can do. Hannes, tell him.
Well, you go to storyworthypodcast.com. On the very first page, you will see a Patreon ad. Just click on it. You can watch it. You can go to patreon.com, and you can help us. You can give us an individual donation. You can give us a monthly donation.
Yeah, it's sort of like
$5 a month.
It's becoming like an ongoing patron of the show. So you're like giving to us so that we can continue doing what we're doing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just think about it. Do you like this show? Obviously, you like the show, or you wouldn't be listening to my voice right now. So give us a couple of bucks.
There you go.
This is the way the world works, people.
this is
how it
all goes
down. This can't go on forever. We're sitting here naked. We're wearing barrels. We've sold all possessions.
And listen, folks, you can always follow us over at Twitter, at Storyworthy. And, of course, we're on the Facebook. Hannes, do you still enjoy the Facebook?
I still do the Facebook, but I'm starting to get sick of it. And I know a lot of people who are done with the Facebook.
Well, I think what you need to do is take a break now and then from Facebook. Like, I really like it, but I'll try to just go on like 3 times a day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And at this point, I've gathered enough, like, people start just friending you because, you know, you have 20 mutual friends, except you're not really friends with them. You know,
my threshold used to be.
I have too many people.
Yeah,
now.
My threshold used to be like we had to have 40 or more mutual friends in common, and now it's 100.
Yeah,
if we have 100 mutual friends in common, I'll be your friend. That's how it goes down.
Yeah, yeah, because I'm starting to see things where I'm like, somebody like this person said this, and I'm like, who the fuck is that?
And then I get a lot
of. I have no idea who this person is.
At least every day, I get 1 to 2. It gets like a spam thing from somebody from Nigeria. But I'm not talking about the money scam. I'm just talking about things that say, I can show you on my phone. It'll be like, hello, dear. You look beautiful. Would you like to chat with me? That kind of stuff. And so then I automatically go to block them. But inevitably, they've already been blocked by somebody else.
By somebody else, yes.
So they're not even on there
anymore.
I
don't get the Nigerian prince. I get the Slavic bad boob job girl who's like, hey, honey. You want FaceTime me?
You know, are very popular in the Slavic countries.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of it. And I'm like, you know that the person writing this is a man. You know the movie Taken?
Oh, gross.
You know the movie Taken?
No.
Oh, well, you are the only person on earth who's never seen the movie Taken with Liam Neeson. He's his daughter is kidnapped by white slavers.
Yes, I do know this.
And they are
this.
Like Slavic and have like beard, those black beards that go all the way down their neck because they've never heard of a razor
I do
in
know
their
this.
Life.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's the guy who's writing to me.
Oh, my God.
You know,
that's
if I
foul.
Wrote back, I'd be like, hey, baby.
All right, listen
Hello,
you guys.
Hello, baby. How are you?
If you go to Facebook.
I'm my boobs. Hard for you. Literally because
First
they're
concrete.
First of all,
I don't
concrete.
Think boobs are supposed to get hard.
No, I'm saying the bad boob job
oh,
from,
I
the
see.
From the former
okay,
Eastern
guys,
Bloc.
Okay, you do. You go to
We've
Facebook.
Gone a little far afield. What were you talking about? I completely lost track.
/ Storyworthy and see us
Patreon
there.
Patreon / Storyworthy.
No, I said Facebook /
Facebook /
It doesn't matter. All right, you guys.
It does matter.
Wherever you are, you guys, stay tuned because Ed Krasnick is on his way here. On Storyworthy, we have voiceover artist Hal Rail.
And I'll be explaining
when it's time to leave home.
That's next time on Storyworthy with the Flavin.
Hi, I'm Kathy Ladman, and you're listening to Storyworthy. Can you hear me? Turn up the volume. That's good.
Back, we've left the Purple Onion and we're now hanging out at the corner of Haight Ashbury and we're doing drugs.
Well, we were here just a few weeks ago with Michael
I forgot
Stahl
there
David.
Were so many drugs involved. I forgot that we were here.
And
a few
that episode,
ago.
By the way, acid did very well. Michael Stahl David tells an extremely humorous story about being on acid, then rapping to his parents. He gets lost. It's very humorous.
Wacky. He wandered into a comedy club. I said, oh, my God, this is horrifying. I 2-drink minimum. Even if I'm on acid, I wouldn't do that. And he stormed out.
All right, you guys. Ed Krasnick is here right now. He's a writer and a producer. He's also a showrunner and a magician. No, he's
and
not
he's
a magician.
He's wearing a bowling shirt with
he's
his name
magician,
stenciled into it.
But he does do an awful lot of things. He's really like all Hollywood all the time. That's what he is.
Yes, he
and
is.
He also has his own podcast out there called The Self-Help Comedy Hour with Ed Krasnick, and that's a really smart show. Have you listened to that, Hannes?
Yes, I have. Ed is a smart guy.
Very
you can tell
smart
because
guy.
His head is bursting through his hair.
Well, and
much
I
like
hear
me. There's not room enough for the brain.
And I hear he's one of those San Francisco comics, and you know what they say
what?
About those guys? Yeah,
all gay.
All
no.
right, you can.
What?
Oh,
is that
brother.
What? Oh, I'm sorry. I went too far. Yeah, there's no possible
intelligentsia,
way.
Intelligentsia again. Back with
intelligentsia
that.
Intelligentsia.
Oh, shoot, intelligentsia.
I got to tell you, that's not a good way to.
It's not
to
it.
Say, well, to mispronounce the word intelligentsia is kind of like the opposite of what it stands for.
And that
for.
Sums up Storyworthy.
That's Storyworthy right there.
All right,
come here
you guys.
To hear words mispronounced, ladies and gentlemen.
Wherever you are.
We're from LA. We can't talk. We're not like San Francisco smart people.
Wherever you
I'm
are,
I'm
going to
eat inauthentic Chinese food now in our pathetic Chinatown in downtown Los Angeles.
Wait a minute. First of all, we have a lovely Chinatown. In Los Angeles. You don't think so?
Yeah, I'm saying from the San Franciscans' point of view. Do you think San Franciscans wouldn't come to Los Angeles and go to our Chinatown and
yeah,
be like,
no, they wouldn't.
Oh,
as I understand
please.
It, Chinatown in San Francisco has the second largest amount of Chinese population in the whole world.
Right, it's kind of like Glendale, which has the largest amount of Armenians in the world, including Armenia.
Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are, please put
Armenians
your hands...
Armenians and Chinese people, this is podcast gold.
All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Ed Krasnick.
Oh, my God. This is too much and yet somehow not enough. I just can't believe it. First of all, talking about San Francisco, I filmed something for VH1 years ago with Peter Noon from Hermit's Hermits. This is how long ago this was. And I was dressed in a purple sari and a blonde wig with long hair. And I was standing at the corner of Haight and Ashbury, and we were filming. Yeah. And no one batted an eye.
Yeah.
And that is what San Francisco is all about.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that San Francisco, you say, you know, smarter. It really was, at a certain time, the coasts Boston and San Francisco, they were like sister cities.
Yeah.
And the most amazing comedy, which is not to say that there wasn't amazing comedy going on other places, right, but there was a high concentration of very creative comedians in San Francisco and in Boston. And I'll give you an example. Now, when I started stand-up in 1847, I was operating a kosher chuck wagon. We had a chicken soup chili, which was very good. And we had Crazy Jews of the Old West. It was a minstrel show. Crazy Jews of the Old West. So at any rate, the first night that I went up and did stand-up, which is probably the last time I did stand-up, this was a Sunday open mic night. It was a place called The Other Cafe. Yeah. The Other Cafe was in Haight-Ashbury. It was a club that you would walk to. Nobody drove. It was a neighborhood. Yeah. And the N Judah train went right by the club. So people would finish their sets and get off in time to catch their train. They would see the train because there was a big glass window. The N Judah. It was a street in San Francisco. Oh. So you'd come off. And people would have long conversations with people in the street. Paula Poundstone would do hours with a lady who was walking by. So it was the most amazing. It really was a very creative comedy club. Anyway, Sunday night, open mic night. This is my first performance. And these were the people that were on the bill, just to show you what San Francisco was like. Dana Carvey, Rob Schneider, Jake Johansson, Paula Poundstone, Nora Dunn, Kevin Meaney, Mike Pritchard, Jeremy Kramer, Bob Sarlat, Greg Proops, and David Spade. Those were open micers. So now you can imagine that that's just like a small percentage of the comedians that were there at the time. Yeah. But all those people, you know, a lot of them went on to become stars, of course. And it was because San Francisco had this amazing support for comedy. Now, Robin Williams, I can't even begin to go on about. I have many friends who were very, very close to him in San Francisco. I was lucky to meet him a number of times and was lucky to bring him up on stage. And I still to this day have never felt an energy like when you know that Robin Williams is in the neighborhood and you hear Robin might be coming, and then you stand there, and the Holy City Zoo was the place that I passed, that I started performing. Holy City Zoo was like 65 seats, and it was in a neighborhood called the Richmond District, San Francisco, so it was on one side of Golden Gate Park, always foggy. Could be summer, could be winter, could be 8 o'clock, shrouded in fog. Always, with comedians standing out front in a circle, with Mike Gandolfi, with all the comedians, and we would tell jokes, and we talk to each other, and we tell stories, and that's our community, and that sustains you in the world of comedy, your community. So now, next to the Holy City Zoo was the Last Day Saloon. The Last Day Saloon was a rock and roll club. So while you're on stage in this 60 seat comedy club, you have next to you the guy who sang Patches, and he's really there. Clarence, whatever his name was. You have Eric Burdon and the Animals. You have Ike Turner. Not Ike and Tina Turner, Ike Turner. And these people are singing, and they are singing over your act, basically. So this is what you had. This is the environment of San Francisco in that particular place. Now, Robin Williams actually popularized the Holy City Zoo. That was a club that he sort of, one of the clubs that he sort of started at, and he sort of made it famous. And so I'm at the Holy City Zoo. Here's what you want to do. You want to pass, which means, like you were saying, Hannes, about the club near where you were in Madison, yeah, that it was sort of like anybody got up and did stand up. Yeah. Here you had to pass for the owner of the club,
yeah,
and he would sit there and he'd watch you. And if he felt you were ready, then you would get a spot, and you'd get a paying spot. Otherwise, you waited for open mic and waited till whenever you could get on. So I was trying to get in there, and it was late at night, and every night they would say, Bob, you got to see this guy, bring him on. Bob Fisher, great comedy, a guy who really knew comedy, and managed and owned the Holy City Zoo. So basically, every night I would wait to go on, and now it's 1 o'clock in the morning, there's two people there, and they'd leave. And then that was it. So this happened night after night after night. I'm preparing my material night after night, week after week, month after month. Finally, they said to Bob, Bob, will you just listen to his act, the other comedians? And there were about 12 to 15 comedians, and they filled in the audience. There was no other audience members. and just them and Bob Fisher. And I made them laugh. And that night was one of the nicest, you know, feelings, because you're making your peers laugh. You're just starting out. And that's how I passed at the Holy City Zoo. And then I started getting spots where I got paid. So to backtrack, Robin Williams, at the Holy City Zoo, you're on stage, you're doing your spots, you're doing stuff, and then you'd hear Robin might be coming. And so you don't know what's going to happen. He may come, he may not come. So he's a big star at that point, a huge star. And the street, all of a sudden, it's like an earthquake. It's a rumbling energy. I've never felt anything like it. And all of a sudden, people start to jam in. They start to fill in. I don't know where he is yet. I haven't seen him. And a guy comes in a red hooded sweatshirt, and he had to pull his hood over his head because if people saw him, he'd never get in there. So he's this little guy in the red sweatshirt, and they say, Robin, coming out. Robin, is there anything you want me to do? The sweetest guy in the world, the nicest guy. And then he goes on stage, and the energy from that audience is like they've seen God. It's just the most unbelievable, pure, spiritual energy. And they're giving it out to him. Now, the thing is, he's a big star. So they give him 5 to 10 minutes. He can do anything he wants for 5 to 10 minutes, and they'll applaud. But then he has to prove that he's Robin Williams. And there's a lot of pressure on for that. You have to give, and that's what I remember, is the energy that he gave and that he had to give whenever he showed up. Now, to his credit, no matter what he did in his life, acting, he's such a brilliant actor and so gifted in so many areas. He was a performer. He was a stand-up. He was an improviser. And that's what he was. So he never went away from that. So 3 months ago, I saw him at the Improv at Eddie Pepitone's show. 4 months ago. And if he liked a comedian, he would come out and support them and show them that he liked them and try to help them by going on stage with them or by being in the back of the club and laughing, whatever. He was a fan of comedians. So you mentioned Sam Kinison. To this day, I think probably one of the best comedians I've ever seen live. Now, I never saw Richard Pryor live or Albert Brooks. I did see Carlin. But Sam Kinison was the best comedian I ever saw live. And this was just when he started to break. Not when he became popular, but just when he started to be on TV. It was a Cobb's Comedy Club, and he would go on for an hour. Half the audience would leave every night. Mm-hmm. And then Robin Williams would come, and they'd do improv for an hour. So that is the example of the kind of patron of comedy that Robin Williams was. Now, the story that I'm going to tell you is a very strange story, but it's also typifies what San Francisco is about as far as comedy goes. They have something up there called Comedy Day. Comedy Day was a festival in Golden Gate Park where they'd have local comedians and headliners, and one Saturday there, I remember 70,000 people. Oh my God. So it's really popular. And 70,000 people. Now, I've never performed in front of 70,000 people, but I did that day. And so there's a bunch of comedians, and there you are. And the whole city gets out to support this. And the comedy is really very good. Yeah. And so people go up. Now, I was hired that time. I think it was Becky Irwin, who was Robin Williams' assistant, and who was helping to run the Holy City Zoo at the time. I got this gig where I was going around interviewing people. And I'm interviewing people with a mic and, you know, running around backstage. And there's a strange array of people backstage. There's a comedy tent. And in the tent is Dianne Feinstein, who I'm interviewing, Robin Williams, Steve Martin, and just a whole bunch of people, some of the SNL people, and then all San Francisco comedians. And they're there, and they're going to perform. So I'm talking to Dianne Feinstein by the hot dog area, not honest to God. And she was the mayor of San Francisco at the time. And I said, Mayor, this has got to be a great day, you know, because this is really when San Francisco shows who they are, you know, what the spirit of the city is. And she says, yes, that's true. And she was eating a hot dog at the time, so I couldn't understand what the hell she was saying. And now, all of a sudden, from the corner, I hear somebody screaming. And they're screaming, and I hear, Krasnick, Ed Krasnick. And I'm interviewing Dianne Feinstein. And I turn around, and a guy who I was in group therapy with at Langley Porter Hospital when I was in San Francisco, because when I was doing stand-up and acting and doing all this stuff, and I still do it, part of the time I was doing that, and the other part of the time I was with self-help people or therapists. So I was in this group, and all of a sudden, I'm talking to Diane Feinstein here. Ed, Krasnick, Henry from group therapy at Langley Porter Hospital. You got better and I didn't. What happened? Verbatim, honest to God. And Diane Feinstein, I turned back and she was gone. Oh. Just a lot of mustard.
Yeah.
And so that was the typical experience. And I've had so many of them in San Francisco and then also in Boston. So I just have to say that the community there was pretty amazing. And you're talking about the comedy boom. Now, this is another little, this is not San Francisco per se, but the Improv was one of the clubs that opened annexes. Mm-hmm. They were in cities, but then they started to open at other places, just like so many other comedy clubs. And there was a woman who booked the Improv. Now, in those days, we didn't have cell phones. And we didn't have dirt. No. And we didn't have air. No, we didn't have cell phones. So you had to call this woman. And if you got her, you would get 34 weeks of work. But if you missed her, you would not get 34 weeks of work. So it was literally like that, and you kept calling and calling and calling, hoping that she would pick up. And there's hundreds of other people calling. And you're waiting to get booked at the Improv. Now, the Improv had annexes. They had Dallas. They had every place in the country, Miami, any city, and you had the Improv. And it was a week's work, and you'd stay at a hotel. And it was 34 weeks.
Yeah.
So it was a big deal. So in those days, that's what we did. We called and we called and we called, and we had to sit by the phone. So the Improv, the comedy boom, was at these places, like you were saying, Hannes, that had no business having comedy. And for a working comedian who's trying to work on their craft, what you learned how to do is you learned how to survive. You didn't learn how to do anything creative because you're talking to an audience that's not listening. And the reason why they're not listening is because we have Bud Friedman, who started the Improv in New York, which was just a club for comedians to come over and hang out and perform for each other. And then it became a business. And then it became, a genre, a way of doing the performance. And then we have a cable show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Once we had the cable show, it was over because people expected, they thought they were watching TV in their living room. So they thought they could talk.
The show. Yeah.
They didn't have to deal with the show. They could get a snack. And then it became about an evening out. Comedy early on, when the Improv first started, and then there became this hierarchy. This you would be a headliner, a middle, or an opener, and there never used to be that.
Yeah.
It used to be a music act, and there would be one comedian, and there'd be another type of act, a host maybe, but there'd never be comedians after comedians. You would never do that. So comedy really shifted, and it really shifted the consciousness, and it's all cyclical. So now we have podcasting, and we have other kinds of personal performing, and we have alternative comedy, or whatever you wanted to call it, people telling more stories. But in those days, you know, it really was, you'd go and you'd do the city, you'd do, like I did Minneapolis, and then we did the Rambo Tour. And the Rambo Tour was 2 weeks where you'd make extra money, 10 hours in between gigs, Devil's Lake, Wisconsin, $5 to sit and $3 to stand. And it was a combine community. And of course, I went out and I said, I'm sorry about your hands. That was like the first thing. We thresher people, no need to applaud.
Yeah.
And it was ridiculous. So I would do that. And then we performed at La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
All kinds of places. So, and myself and a guy named Joe Keyes, and I know Mike has done this, Gandolfi, and a lot of people. It was 10 hours in between gigs. So it's Fargo, North Dakota. You're performing at the Westward Ho, which is a place that has a boot-shaped swimming pool. And that's probably pretty much all. And a tumbleweed goes by and it says, fuck it. You know, I mean, it was a strange place. But the life of a comedian, I mean, and so to bring it around, San Francisco, I was very lucky to be a performer there. There was a lot of great comedy happening in a lot of other places, but it just seemed like there was a heavy concentration of people and a community that really supported each other, and a city that really supported comedy. So that's kind of what. And to circle back, I don't want to take too long here, but to circle back, because this is kind of a, I said that half the time I did stand up or performing, and half the time I was into self help. Well, here's the thing. When I think of Robin, and I think of Rich Jenny, and I think of some of the people that we've lost. There isn't any group in the world, and I'm not talking about life and death. I'm not talking about war refugees. I'm not talking about that kind of serious stuff. But comedians have more going on with them inside that has less to do what they're putting on outside than any other group I've ever seen. It's complete schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, there's never been a more important time for people, especially the comedy community, maybe people can learn something, to look inside themselves and to get help. Because mental health and comedy are connected in a great way, but not for comedians. Only on stage, only in performing. Then the performance stops. And then for many people, depression, anxiety, mental illness, all kinds of things, addictions, that's what your life is. It's not performing, because you can only perform 1 hour a day. Mm-hmm. So the thing about it is that's why I started doing, years ago, performances that united self-help and comedy. And that's how I started doing the Self-Help Comedy Hour and other shows like it. Because I really believe that there's no bigger healing element than humor and emotion. But that if you resist the emotion that's inside of you, what happens is you get sick. And you get all kinds of things that are happening. It's really a microcosm of what's happening with the world, because people are pushing down all their stuff, all their feelings. Everybody's very angry. They feel that they are angry instead of the feeling of anger. Mm. You're not a feeling. You're not angry. You feel angry. Mm-hmm. If you can accept it and let it go and release it. And this is true of any emotion. It's just energy. It's the kind of energy that we had when we saw Robin Williams. Yeah. But that stuff has to come out. It has to have room to come out. And it has to be attended to. And so when it's not attended to, it gets to be a very dark place. So that's why, that's why I want to work in this kind of way, in this kind of field. It's personal for me. It's not a theory. It's something that I've experienced, and I've experienced what it's like when I resist my own, what's going on inside me. Because we think that what's going on outside can help you. That if you're successful, and if you make it in this country, and if you're an entertainer especially, you have it made. Well, if we didn't learn from Robin Williams that that's not true, I don't know when you're going to learn it. It is not, freedom comes from inside, not from outside. And that's where it comes from. It is not outside you. And in a way, we're led to believe, even by the country itself, and I'm not saying that this is what the founding fathers had in mind, but I'm saying when you hear life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you don't hear life, liberty, and happiness. You hear the pursuit of happiness, which presumes that it's outside of you. And when you, nothing will make you more unhappy than pursuing happiness that's outside of you. There is nothing that will make you more unhappy.
Ed, man, exactly. I feel like, do I have to pay you? Do I owe you money? Do you take insurance?
He's from San Francisco. You need to barter corn.
I'm ready for corn.
Motion picture insurance, yeah, because, yeah. Boy, that is, you really encapsulated so much right there, and I really want to talk about Robin Williams. First of all, I wish he had been on your show.
Yeah, I would have loved to have had him on my show. I was lucky enough to I had a nice conversation with him maybe 6 months ago. And very, just a great guy.
It's
just a
so
sweet man.
True how he tried to help his friends, and he supported comedy because, he did my friend Matt Oswalt's Puddin' Strip 2 or 3 times, actually.
Yeah.
And Matt even said to me one time, like, I'll bet you I can get Robin Williams on Storyworthy. And I said, Matt, give me a break. I'm not going to get Robin Williams on Storyworthy. And he goes, Christine, he's like the nicest guy in the world, and he really supports the little guy. And I remember that, and I was so,
He does. He was the...
First you slapped him and said, how dare you say I'm a little guy? And then he said, well, really? No, it's amazing. The whole Robin Williams thing is as we record this, very fresh.
Yeah.
And I'm, it's been weird for me because, I was like Robin Williams, but he wasn't my top guy, but his death has really affected me. Mm-hmm. I think because he committed suicide and my dad committed suicide.
Mm-hmm. Oh my.
And when I'm like, and I realize it's like us people are like, it's the coward's way out. People are being assholes. And it's like that never occurred to me that it, I never thought Robin Williams, you're being selfish. But that's exactly what I thought when my dad died. And it's actually easier for me to forgive Robin Williams than it is my dad, and that happened 25 years
ago.
Well,
how do you think Robin Williams, his two children feel?
No, that's how they feel. But I realize that, of course, yeah, nobody's going to kill themselves if you kill yourself if you just can't stand it.
And it's
think how hard it is. That's what it made me think. Of course, I've heard all these gruesome details, but it's hard to do.
It's not. That's not who that person is.
Yeah.
Something else has happened in them.
Yeah.
That has happened in a moment. That is not who that person is. People don't kill themselves. Chemicals.
I know. I know people who should. You would look at their lives and go, your life is a complete disaster. How have you not killed yourself? Because, yeah, you're right. People don't kill themselves. People, outside influences.
Right. There are lots of things that are going on. There's chemistry. You know, for the first time in the world, we're studying the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's something in the brain that we can learn.
And we're
studying that the brain is elastic. It can change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It actually can change. We are finding that out now. So just as it can change toward the darkness, it can change toward other ways. But you brought up, that's something, I'm sorry that you had that experience.
Well, if you had listened to episode 35, a story where you would know. No, but yes, thank you. No,
he was 19 at the time as well, and Hannes found his father.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was listening to Robin Williams' album, actually. At the time. He was not, come on, Robin Williams would laugh at that joke.
That's the slightest joke I heard about it, that I'm sort of smiling.
It's not really a... I know, it's funny, though, because people have being such... They're like, he had everything. It's like, it's not, you know, that doesn't happen because you don't have things. And they're,
but Ed,
our friend Rick Overton, who is a friend of the show,
sure,
is very much trying to get out to people the idea, which I had never heard before, and I heard Dr. Drew saying it, and I think it's true. Heart surgery often leads, apparently, directly to tremendous depression.
Yeah.
Like it causes a physical change in your brain chemistry.
Right.
But also, don't you think
a different state.
Part of this could have been that his series was just canceled? He was looking for a comeback with the crazy ones.
I don't believe that for one second.
And the network put millions of dollars into advertising for this show, and Robin was going to, you know, be back on top of the television world, and then that didn't happen. I'm just saying, you're talking about a guy who craves those highs, those moments when he would be on stage in such a manic state. I mean, he's on top of the world now. He wants that back.
Yeah,
and then it got...
It doesn't help.
It's not
the stress of it is not helping. However, that is not what makes a person take their life.
Yeah, I don't...
No, but it's a cumulative effect, obviously. Sure. Many things.
But that's thinking of it like... You know, this is the problem with, again, I've always thought the word fun and the word funny are too close in English because, like, what's funny is often not fun. Like, describing things that happened to you that were fun is boring. Describing the worst day of your life, hilarious. And it's like depression and depression should be two different words. Everybody is depressed sometimes. That's not depression. That's not capital D medical condition depression, which I used to suffer from all the time. It's like when you are depressed medically, it doesn't matter what's going on outside of you.
Right.
You can have a great day. And that's what is the frustrating and maddening part, literally, about it, is you're like, this doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a great day. Why do I feel like I'm about to be hit by a train?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's not the same thing as just being unhappy. Like, you know, your dog died. Well, of course you're depressed about that. That's not medically depressed.
But
that's not it's not the same condition.
But the world right now is in a state of constant resistance and constant depression and constant fear and panic, which is on the other side.
I like what you said about people being the emotion instead of feeling it.
Yeah,
because that's all talk radio is like, I hate Obama, or I hate Rush Limbaugh. It's like you can't spend your whole day.
These are feelings.
People.
Feelings aren't who you are. Yeah. They're energy that goes through you. They're not who you are, and they always change. If you let them, if you hold on to them and you resist them, then you become those things.
So, Hannes, have you forgiven your father now, do you think?
I haven't thought about it in years, but the Robin Williams is making me think about it. Like, maybe I do need to, because I was really like, this is fucking bullshit. It's like you're fucking nuts for years you're an asshole for years. Actually, I thought he was an asshole, and I realized every time stuff. Oh, you were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't, you know, it's like, oh, you weren't just being a dick. You didn't know what the fuck was going on in the world. So I'm closer to forgiving him now than I ever would have been
before. Because he was helpless in a lot of ways. He didn't have anybody to reach out to. There wasn't a lot of therapy then. What could he have done?
We didn't have the chemical help that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
The brain drugs, to put it as bluntly as possible, that we have now, we didn't have 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There was still, he could have done more, but you know what? But maybe he couldn't. Like, there are things that I want to do, I find myself incapable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I want to organize this Twitter. Exactly. It's like, I want to organize, you know, my life. I want to do this. I want to do more. It's like, and then you're sitting there and you're like, I can think of 1,000 things. And because I can think of 1,000 things I need to do, I feel completely stymied and I'm not going to do a single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just I'd like to just talk myself out of it, because people are like, well, why don't you just think about happy things? It's like, you can't talk yourself out of it.
Right.
You can do work that will help you go out of it, but you can't just sit and talk to yourself in your own head.
But usually there's a resistance, there's a thought that's coming, and the thought is, if I'm not doing something, then there's something wrong with me. Then it's not okay.
Right.
Then
that's why I've had to learn that it's okay if I don't do things. Now, I've probably gone too far in the other direction where I don't do enough, but it's like I had to learn that it was okay, and I shouldn't be beating myself every moment that I'm not doing something to advance my career.
And what's painful is the beating yourself up.
Yeah.
Not the feeling. The feeling is not, the pain doesn't come from the feeling. It comes from the statement that I'm not okay and there's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come from feeling sad or feeling angry or feeling whatever. That's just a feeling.
Yeah.
So I really commend you, Ed, the self-help comedy hour with Ed Krasnick, because you are trying to kind of marry these two ideas of happiness and accomplishment, it seems, or not accomplishment.
Well, I give you an example of how, you know, humor and emotion. We do a show where a guest comes on and they talk about a real life issue. And then there's a therapist who's a role play expert.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a panel of comedic actors. And along with the therapist, they act out their issue.
Right. Instead I remember the one about the woman doing a eulogy at a funeral.
Right.
Her mother's funeral.
Right. Right. And there are millions of, you know, we've done it a number of times.
Scenarios that
it's scenarios created. That are happening in your life, and then you act them out, and you're play acting, but you're not talking about the problem. You're talking to the problem. So instead of talking about my mother, an actor will play my mother.
So it gives you an aha moment because you're seeing it apart from you.
Yes. And the audience is in front of it, and it's emotional. You're thinking, I'm making this up. But as the words come, so do the feelings.
Yeah.
And this is such a great television show idea.
I learned this years ago in therapy, one of the only things I can actually say I learned specifically, which is your subconscious does not know the difference between reality and fantasy. Which is why something like that can work. But I learned it in the context of you can't just sit and there's a phrase called catastrophizing. You can't just sit and imagine the worst possible outcome, because you will feel exactly as if that actually happened, because your subconscious doesn't know. And the way it was demonstrated to me is like, close your eyes and stand up. Close your eyes. Now, I want you to vividly imagine you are standing on the edge of the cliff. Now step forward. Your body won't let you step forward. You know, consciously, I'm standing in a room. Mm-hmm. I'm not on the edge of a cliff. If you're imagining you're on the edge of a cliff, your subconscious is like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? And it's like, so when you're talking to a play actor or someone playing your mother, your subconscious, you're talking to your mother. It doesn't know you're not talking to your mother.
Right, and you're being guided by somebody who's a professional who works with people and uses this as a technique.
And it's not a game, right?
No, it's not a game. It's not a game, and it's not ha-ha-ha.
It's entertaining.
It's really funny.
And
entertaining.
Yes, pain is funny. That's the thing.
But not even the pain. It's mixed. People don't feel mixed things in this culture. There's no mixture. You can't be sad and have happiness. You can't be angry.
Yeah,
and
we're all programmed.
That's a blanket statement, though, because I think some people are of a very healthy mind and body. And
no,
they
but
are,
I'm saying through media.
Through media, right? But the thing is the people that are of healthy mind and body don't spend all their time in front of the television and don't just read bad news.
Right, that's true.
You know, I mean, it's the celebrity magazines, things like that, that people right. get full of anxiety looking at Facebook, seeing everybody moving ahead, but then feeling themselves are not moving ahead.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of people that can control. So it's not everybody.
No, but it's a culture. It's a cultural thing.
It's an American thing?
It's an American thing.
I think it is American coming
American
from... from the media, because media, television, radio, has to be programmed.
Mm.
Fox News is the most blatant example of it, but it's not the only one. It's like, if I go to my barber and I have to sit there for an hour waiting, it's like, and they watch Fox News, I'm like rolling my eyes, but it's like, it will go from show to show to show, and each one will have exactly the same 3 points.
Right.
President Obama did this. Not like a different take on what he did.
No, it's the same thing.
It's the same exact, and it's programmed. So it's like, yeah, there are radio stations that are all liberal and radio stations that are all conservative. And if you listen to one or the other, you think that that's the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, and so this mixture of, you know, a lot of times you go out, you go out to a show and you think, oh, my God, I'm going to see another show. It's Thursday night.
Yeah.
When am I going to get home? You know, I mean, this is what you're thinking because people are tired.
People are tired.
Why are they so tired? Why are people so tired? You know why they're tired? They're tired of surviving. People are surviving. It's a survive. You're not living.
Well, the economy has definitely put that stress on a lot of people, I'll say.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, we got to wrap this up.
I know.
We do. But I want to ask two things. Number one, half of your time now is still in therapy and half is being creative. Please tell me that's not true.
No. It's not therapy, but it's like I'm learning practices that help me. Of the things that I'm doing that resist what's going on inside, you know, and it's a daily practice. It's
okay.
Not like, oh, hey, everything's good. It's the nature of things.
But you don't feel clinically depressed now.
I have my moments.
Okay.
Yeah, I have my moments.
But you have never thought about suicide
or anything
like that.
No, I don't think about suicide. I don't.
Because they say that people that end up accomplishing it have been thinking about it. They've thought of ways. They've thought of plans.
Yeah, I don't.
Okay.
That's not me. I don't think about those things.
Good.
But I do. I have
it's where not
bulldozed
being able to plan
myself
really
for
comes
years.
In handy.
Yeah. You know, okay. I mean, I've denied. You know, I'm the king of putting a label on. Oh, that's a feeling. It must be something wrong with me.
Mm.
I mean, I grew up that way. So you know, I'm learning new techniques and I'm always doing it and I'm interested in it. You know?
Hey, listen, we want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy, but first tell me just what was the feeling for you in terms of the energy, the difference and the similarities between Kinison and Robin Williams?
The similarity is that both people, when they were on stage, felt like they were free.
Mm.
It wasn't a pressure as much as there was a freedom to Sam Kinison. Sam Kinison, you talk about emotion. He was feeling, he was talking about things that he felt
mm-hmm.
he had experienced, and he was experiencing them in front of you. It wasn't like, hey, let me see what I can do to get laughs.
Mm-hmm.
It was, this is going to be an experience now. And that's what you felt with Robin Williams, too, energetically. It was an energy that was an experience. These people are experiencing it. They're not being technicians.
They're almost like evangelical or evangelists.
Well, he was, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what Kinison was.
He was,
right.
Yeah.
So they're almost like these motivational speakers. I mean, they're getting everybody with them, everybody together.
It's energy, but it comes from what's really being experienced in the moment. And that's another, you know, great key. That's why they were so great. Another great key of when you're experiencing it in the moment, you can get through it.
Hey, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
We'd love to.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the Storyworthy Wheel of Truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
School days. Wow, everybody loves that. Okay. Oh, I have to tell a story. My favorite time of school was when the teacher said, please, you've all been very, very bad. You have to put your heads down. And the reason why I was happy, because I said, finally, I can rest and not have to listen to these people for 2 seconds. And I put my head down, and I'd just be so happy, and I felt a sense of peace. I didn't know what it was mm-hmm. when I was a kid, because I was a kid. But I felt a sense of peace, and no one was better in second grade at putting their heads down. Ed Krasnick, head down champ.
Top of the class.
Top of the class. Yeah.
So did you used to have to, in elementary school, get like a little rug or a little remnant to sleep on during rest time? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
They would say, now remember, on Monday, you have to bring in your remnant. That's what they called it, a remnant, like a little piece of carpet.
Oh, yeah.
And then when it was, you know, rest time, you would curl up on that little piece of carpet over there by the...
Now, what did you bring? Bricks. What did you bring?
A little piece of shag carpet. It was a burnt orange, because in the 70s, burnt orange and avocado, those were the two colors.
They really were.
And so I would bring this little burnt orange carpet in every year, like a little dog carrying
it to
school.
My mother, not being from this country, misunderstood and would make avocados and burn oranges and then squeeze them over the avocado. She didn't understand it wasn't a recipe.
Are you? No, no.
It's a joke.
Burnt orange. Oh, it's not that funny. That's the thing.
Wow. Did you I feel like I'm at open mic night. It's like 1 a.m.
Yeah.
You were like Mitzi Shore there. You were like, that's not funny.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Ed, is the Holy City Zoo or the Last Day Saloon, are those establishments still open in San Francisco?
No, unfortunately they're not.
What's open up there anymore?
Well, the Punchline is a comedy club, and the Cobbs Comedy Club is a comedy club.
Yeah. Paula Poundstone, she was always at the Punchline, right?
She was always at the Punchline. She was always at the Other Cafe.
She's
brilliant. And a great storyteller.
Yeah,
talk brilliant. About a great storyteller.
And were you friends with her as well then?
No. I mean, I know her, but I was not. I unfortunately never really had the pleasure of performing with her, but I've talked with her.
She's amazing.
She's brilliant.
I think so. Yeah. And Jeremy Kramer, that's another one.
One of my favorites.
Oh my gosh.
One of my
favorites. Jeremy Kramer, one of the smartest comic minds
Jeremy
ever.
Kramer would look at the Holy City Zoo. He'd look at the audience. This is a man who was comfortable with silence.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd look at the audience and they wouldn't laugh. And he'd go like this. Good. Okay. All right. Good. Good.
Yeah, and then they
he took it as a challenge.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like, he's fantastic.
Yeah. Like he's getting ready for the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that
good?
Fabulous? I love it.
Good.
All right, you guys, we got to wrap this up right about now. I'd like to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including our new sound guy, Scott Christopher.
Scott Christopher.
Yay,
he's
Scott.
Dancing in the corner right now.
He's handsome. He's punctual. Very professional.
He's wearing a very hip plaid
and
shirt.
And I like it.
That's designed to look as if it's something he got from his uncle, but really paid probably thousands of dollars
for it. I'm excited to have him.
Yeah.
I'd also like to thank Sean Merrick here at Sideshow Network. And, of course, John Thomas Griffith. You know, he's the guy that wrote the theme song, Follow Me, Hannes.
I feel a great anger when I hear his name, but I realize the anger is not who I am.
That's exactly right. And on behalf of our storyteller tonight, Ed Krasnick, thanks for coming, friend.
Thank you guys so much.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's always great to see you.
And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.